From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In Pakistan, often described as our most important partner in the war on terror, anti-American sentiment has never been greater. And this month's elections suggest that growing anger against the United States is changing the political complexion of that nation. Pakistan's Islamic religious parties, which usually occupy a handful of seats in the National Assembly, captured 50, becoming the third largest party and a force to reckon with. Anti-Americanism has deep roots in Pakistan, but steadily fanning the flames is the Pakistani press, with fuel provided in part by leaders of the American Christian right. For instance, when the Reverend Jerry Falwell called Muhammad a terrorist on the CBS program 60 Minutes. Professor Akbar Ahmed teaches Islamic studies at American University in Washington, D.C., and he joins us now. Professor Ahmed, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
How widely covered were the remarks of Jerry Falwell and similar remarks by the Reverend Franklin Graham, son of Billy, and also the Reverend Jerry Vines, the former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, who called Muhammad a demon-possessed pedophile? Did you see these all over the front pages of all the papers?
Yes, they were being reported both in the English press and in the Urdu press, that is the main Pakistani language, Urdu. And Pakistanis were feeling that their prophet was under attack, Islam was under attack, and both these attacks were coming from the United States, and these are supposed to be men of God. Pakistanis in particular tend to be very, very sensitive, and if you remember the agitation against Salman Rushdie and his book, The Satanic Verses, actually started in Pakistan and people were killed in Islamabad. So the reaction was, we must then give the vote to those people who will defend Islam. And the people who are going to defend Islam are the religious parties.
So what you're saying is that the remarks of a small, though very vocal, minority have become identified with America as a whole.
Yes, that is what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that in Pakistan, very few people would make the distinction of what, say, Falwell is saying and what President Bush is saying. Remember, they don't make too much of a difference between an official position and an individual position, because many of these countries are run by military strongmen, so that the official position and the private position are more or less intertwined.
Falwell did issue a kind of qualified apology. Was that reported anywhere in the Pakistani press?
Yes, that was reported, but remember that, number one, the damage had already been done. Number two, that he is one of the several people who made some very offensive remarks about the prophet.
We know that at least parts of the Pakistani press are prone to pick up conspiracy theories. They did after September 11th. Have there been any conspiracy theories with relation to the attacks in Bali?
Yes, conspiracy theories are very popular in that part of the world. Not so much in the English press, but certainly in the local press. In Bali, the conspiracy theories that it was all a CIA plot to involve the Muslim world and to show the Muslim world in a very poor light.
The English language paper Dawn is probably the most influential in Pakistan, or so we've heard, and it's been traditionally a moderating influence, and it has pretty much reflected the views of the upper classes. How has that reporting changed?
I always take the Dawn as a kind of yardstick because it's quite a sober paper and carries some excellent articles, and at the same time reflects the senior levels of government. And I've been reading columns in the Dawn over the last 1 year since last September. And it had begun with a clear-cut position of supporting America, of being aligned with America and sympathizing with America. And then over the months, its position shifted and an increasing criticism began to appear. And recently, of course, there's been scathing criticism both of Musharraf and American foreign policy. Even in the Dawn.
And do you think that the Pakistani press is merely reflecting the public opinion there?
I think it's a good yardstick to gauge what public opinion is. If you want to know what the elite is thinking, read the English press. If you want to know what the real feeling is of the population of Pakistan, read the Urdu press. This is a rough and ready method of understanding Pakistan's society, but that is how I would do it.
And what about the U.S. media? What responsibility do the U.S. media have for public opinion and political outcomes in Pakistan?
I think that the U.S. media has been working on a hit-or-miss method, which means that, for instance, this reporting about the prophet, I don't even think they were aware of the impact this would make in the Muslim world or in Pakistan. there's a far greater reaction or sensitivity to anything coming from the United States in terms of Islam. That's going to make it much more difficult when America decides to go into Iraq. That'll make it much more difficult when it decides to take action, say, against even the Al-Qaeda in that part of the world. And therefore, the American media, the American press needs to be aware that it is no longer a neutral spectator or observer. It is a participant in the drama. And I'm afraid, with lack of understanding, it's sometimes scoring goals against its own team.
Okay. Akbar Ahmed, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Akbar Ahmed is a professor of Islamic studies at American University and the author of many prize-winning books on Islam. His latest is called Islam Today.
The history of the press's relationship with the military is a history, in more ways than one, of conflict. The two institutions have many overlapping interests and many that coincide not at all. For instance, military failure is not a subject the Pentagon easily warms to, but one the media believe to be critically important to citizens. In the past, individual news organizations have lobbied hard for greater access to war zones and to personnel in the field and at the Pentagon. What they have gotten in successive U.S. deployments on all those fronts is less and less. Now, as we charge toward a second Gulf War, military correspondents themselves have banded together to fight the same fight. Their group is called Military Reporters and Editors, MRE for short. USA Today reporter Dave Moniz is a founder of MRE, and he joins us now. Dave, welcome to On the Media.
Well, thank you very much.
Let's just lay some groundwork. We're in the middle of one war, a very peculiar war against terrorism, and it seemed to be on the verge of another in Iraq, a second Gulf War. What is at the top of the MRE agenda?
Well, obviously, I think we have a very keen interest in continuing dialogue with the Department of Defense to ensure that those reporters covering the next war have the kind of access that would be required to really explain to the public how, when, where, why this war is being fought. And I think, to be quite candid, there is a lingering feeling within the media that we did not have this kind of access during the first year of covering the war on terrorism. There were numerous accounts of reporters who traveled with American forces in Kandahar and other cities within Afghanistan and simply were restricted from interviewing troops returning from missions, leaving to undertake missions. And we're not necessarily talking about special forces or other types of clandestine operations, but perhaps troops that were involved in more conventional kinds of operations were pretty much off limits.
What keeps, in your opinion, the civilian leadership of the Defense Department and the military itself from giving journalists the kind of access that they're looking for?
Well, personal opinion, I think secrecy, to be quite honest, seems to be a hallmark of this administration. I'm not sure with the civilian leadership of the Pentagon there's ever been a sufficient building of trust with the media that would be required to open up opportunities that could be seen as a little bit risky by those in the Pentagon. But I think there is some risk, but there is also a lot to be gained by telling the public a very compelling story about how its men and women have, in many cases, very successfully fought this war.
Well, coverage of all U.S. wars, including Vietnam, has had two parts, the part that actually glorifies the military and trumpets its successes, and also the part that puts a very close eye on accidents, on bad strategy, on civilian casualties, on all of the things that any institution would prefer to keep under wraps. Do you think the military will ever buy into the benefits of rigorous coverage versus the disadvantages of having embarrassments revealed to the American people?
That's a great question, but I don't really view the military as a monolith. There certainly are all kinds of precedents that would suggest that sort of the old stereotypes aren't necessarily accurate and don't necessarily have to be the model for the way that we cover conflicts. There were generals during the Gulf War, for example, who brought reporters into their units, briefed them on what kinds of operations they were about to undertake, and gave them complete access to the battlefield. As far as I can tell, not one of those generals came to regret that decision.
Let me ask you one last question. Now, MRE stands for Military Reporters and Editors. But as I am sure you are only too well aware, it is also an Army acronym for Meals Ready to Eat. You're going into a theater of war, in all probability. Do you really want to be seen as a meal ready to eat?
I would defer to those within the group who selected the name. I wasn't present when we gave birth to that name. How's that for a cop-out?
Well, it's worthy of a Pentagon briefer, actually. Dave Moniz, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dave Moniz is the Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. Earlier this year, he won the 15th Gerald R. Ford Prize for Distinguished Reporting on National Defense, and he is one of the founders of Military Reporters and Editors.
And now for some of your letters. Listener Debbie Polhemus writes to compliment us for our questioning of Al Jazeera managing editor Ibrahim Halal on the cable channel's political sympathies. She continues, however, I was left dissatisfied with your questions about Al Jazeera's even-handedness regarding coverage of civilian casualties. What does even-handed mean in today's wars? OTM has reported that the Pentagon won't count civilian dead, that aid organizations can't be trusted, that reporters are kept far from the battlefield. What is the neutral yardstick against which Al Jazeera should be measured?
The Reverend Richard T. Kunzman of Pine City, New York, wrote to upbraid us for including a guest's term, nut house, for St. Elizabeth Psychiatric Hospital in Washington. When educated and sophisticated people make such remarks, how will we ever get beyond the stigma of mental disease?
Finally, Robin Edgerton of New York City writes to expand on our story about Marvel comic book superhero The Thing's Jewish heritage. Rival DC Comics also had a Jewish superhero, Colossal Boy, a.k.a. Gim Alon.
Please send your letters to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, stories that transfix us. Today, an anonymous sniper. 15 years ago, a baby named Jessica.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The panic created by random sniper attacks in and around Washington has been intense. The coverage, locally and globally, has been intense. And it wasn't long before the criticism of that coverage became intense as well, exemplified by the frustrated tongue-lashing delivered by Montgomery County Police Chief Charles Moose.
I beg of the media, let us do our job. If the community wants you to do it, they will call today, and we will have a vote. And if it's decided that Channel 9 is going to investigate this case, then so be it. So be it.
More second-guessing came in last Sunday's Washington Post, where psychologist Harvey Goldstein accused the media of egging on the sniper by, in effect, taunting him and feeding him the publicity he craves. But former reporter-turned-University of Maryland journalism ethicist Chris Hansen doesn't buy it.
No, I don't. So far as I'm concerned, we don't really know what is motivating this killer. Maybe he's driven by the desire to get more and more media coverage. Maybe he's driven by something else, like a desire to kill. maybe if the amount of coverage were diminished, he would be more motivated to go out and kill because he wants to get back in the news. We simply don't know.
Let's say he is the number one audience member of all of this overheated publicity about the crimes. If that's true, do the media have a responsibility to somehow measure their words in a way that they ordinarily wouldn't?
Well, lives are at stake, and of course reporters should measure their words very, very carefully. The problem is you don't often know what words will lead to what results. Dr. Goldstein is saying that reports about schools being safe led the killer to go in front of a school. That might be true, and it might not. So, yes, you have to be careful, but I think that reporters should just go on about doing their jobs. The role of the media in a case like this is essential, and it's not fair to blast the media as a bunch of jackals who are there simply to take advantage of misfortune. They're helping the police, in many cases, to do their job.
That's the news, but the media and the news channels are a whole lot more than news. There are endless talk shows and endless experts of various stripes paraded before the viewers to speculate about what's going on. Should they have a particular responsibility themselves to be circumspect about this and just to shut their flapping lips for once?
Well, I think that any so-called expert, psychologist, retired profiler or whatever who goes on to a show like that obviously should be very, very thoughtful and careful about what they say. It turns out that much of what they say contradicts each other. Some of them say that it's a mistake ever to call this killer a coward. Others say it's helpful to call him a coward. Others say you should never call him a sniper. There's so much disagreement about what will set this guy off. And so you assemble a bunch of people who give their various opinions about it, and you create a Tower of Babel on television. It's confusing. How damaging it is very hard to assess. I'm not sure if it's damaging at all, other than perhaps to the dignity of the news business.
You have been a journalist and you have been a journalism critic. From your perspective, what has the press done wrong?
Well, a friend of mine told me that she had seen a local news report where children were being taken home from school in the wake of the school shooting. A reporter was there, and he talked to the father of this child and then put the microphone to the child, who then just burst down in tears. I don't think it's a very good idea to shove a microphone in front of a kid in circumstances like that. Here's another one. After the recent shooting, reporters were standing in the lot and endlessly repeating the news that had already happened. It later turned out that the police had failed to close off a number of the smaller highways around the area, and so they tried to snap a dragnet down on the area that had left a number of gaps. It would have been interesting if some of the reporters had actually gone out and done some reporting and found out how effective this thing had been, and then once they were sure that the guy had gotten away, report that. The final thing I'd say is that from my standpoint, the low point of all the reporting came on an ABC program with the title In the Crosshairs. Evidently, because they didn't have too much new to report, the network decided to report on itself, and they went and interviewed a number of ABC correspondents who live in the D.C. area and who have children and who acknowledge that they, too, were fearful, they, too, feel vulnerable. And it came across rather like a good advertisement rather than as a news report. And, you know, maybe it was intended to inoculate the network against the next round of media bashing. But I'm old-fashioned, and I'd always been told by my editors that, you know, you're not supposed to make yourself a part of the story. And here we have a very strange inversion of that that made me a little nauseated.
All right. Well, Chris Hansen, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Chris Hansen teaches journalism ethics at the University of Maryland.
Media frenzies can be generated by stories both large and small. Sometimes it's hard to predict which events will capture the nation's imagination. But history tells us that the public will always respond to stories about people trapped in holes. On an early morning 15 years ago this past Wednesday, an 18-month-old girl playing in her backyard in Midland, Texas, fell into a well. By the time she was freed, 58 hours later, everyone in America would know her name, Jessica McClure. On the Media's Mike Pesca looks back not just on baby Jessica, but on the media magic that is created when a person is trapped underground.
2.5 months ago, 9 miners from Somerset County, Pennsylvania, were freed from the Kew Creek mine. A safety expert from the United Mine Workers Union called the rescue unprecedented in modern times. Miraculous? Yes. Unprecedented? Decidedly not. Man, or men, or sometimes babies trapped underground, has been a story for as long as people have been telling stories, or at least selling them in newspapers or broadcasting them. There was the case of Floyd Collins.
You never heard of Floyd Collins?
That's Kirk Douglas in the 1951 movie Ace in the Hole. He plays a journalist who stumbles across a man trapped in a cave. Here he reminds a Cub reporter about a similar story.
Floyd Collins, doesn't that ring a bell?
No, not to me it doesn't.
1925, Kentucky? The guy pinned way down in that cave? One of the biggest stories that ever broke. Front page in every paper in the country for weeks.
Maybe I did hear about it.
Maybe you heard that a reporter on the Louisville paper crawled in for the story and came out with a Pulitzer Prize.
It's true. The 1926 Pulitzer Prize for reporting was awarded to William Burke Miller of the Louisville Courier-Journal. Miller, known as Skeets, became a character in the 1995 musical Floyd Collins, which dealt with the drama in the cave and the chaos in the newsroom.
K City, comma, capital K, capital Y, February 4. K victim losing hope.
According to Skeets Miller, comma, Collins is quickly slipping into a state of deep despair.
Asking for milk.
The trapped man was heard to cry out, folks, get me out of here, comma, even if you have to tear my foot off. Explanation, close quote.
Floyd is reported to be in a state of delirium, conversing with the cave crickets and even begging them to hurry, 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 call me out.
A little more than a decade after Floyd Collins, reporter J. Frank Willis of the Canadian Radio Commission covered the collapse of the Moose River Mine in Nova Scotia, Canada.
It is a broken country down here, drab and desolate. A country of scrub and second growth, of rock. Rock, relentless, hard, cruel hard. It is against rock of this sort that miners for the past week have fought and fought, grim-lipped, determined, and they're winning their fight. Inch by inch, the rock is retreating.
Today, news networks never leave these stories. Even if little is happening on the scene, time will be filled with talking heads, recovery experts, and, in the absence of that, speculation. Willis, however, was fiercely committed to the notion that only that which was newsworthy should be broadcast.
As a rumor has gone abroad and has been published as a fact that the mine is in danger of caving in, this is absolutely not true. We're standing here, we can spit into this pit, and yet, from thousands of miles away, people are contradicting what we have to say. This must stop. I'm stopping these broadcasts now until something definite happens.
One man died, two survived. The Moose River cave-in was one of the first times that radio displayed its power to connect with listeners on a real-life event occurring in real time. A decade later, TV would demonstrate that ability in its coverage of yet another person trapped in a hole. In 1949, 3-year-old Kathy Fiscus fell into a well near Los Angeles. Local station KTLA's round-the-clock coverage was groundbreaking in that it proved TV could find ample drama outside the scripted world of the studio. In fact, it was a KTLA reporter who informed her family that Kathy had died. Her grave marker reads, "A little girl who brought the world together for a moment." Almost 40 years later, there was another moment. Another little girl was trapped in a well. Jessica McClure. Mary Alice Williams was one of CNN's primary anchors in 1987.
We were the only ones on the air when this 18-month-old baby girl fell into a well. And suddenly, all the huge international stories melted away. Of course, many, many hours later, the broadcast networks caught on to the drama of this event.
We were still rather looked down on by the other networks. They didn't consider us to be equals.
Bob Fernad was CNN's vice president and senior producer during the Jessica McClure rescue.
Our ratings shot up as people left the three broadcast networks, assuming correctly so that they do the story and then go back to their regular programming and that we'd stay with it. And our ratings spiked, and for the first time, we beat the three broadcast networks in eyeballs.
And that's what made the Jessica McClure story a watershed for CNN. It confirmed what was an operating theory, that this new way of covering a story, wall to wall, was the formula for success. However, former anchor Mary Alice Williams thinks cable news took the wrong lesson from the little girl in the well.
What it led to was the wall-to-wall coverage of O.J. Simpson. And the motive for watching O.J. was pure prurience. There was no other reason. It was a collective schadenfreude. Look how the mighty have fallen. Baby Jessica wasn't that. It was the opposite. It was a collective hope, a collective prayer to save a person's life, a baby's life.
Such is the fine line in TV news between pathos and bathos, between bathos and exploitation. It's not a happily ever after story for the rest of the Jessica McClure participants either. Jessica herself still lives in Texas, plays the French horn, and makes A's and B's in school. She has a trust fund in excess of $1 million. The only interview she does is with Ladies Home Journal, which recently revealed that Jessica has juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Her parents, teenagers at the time, divorced. Her rescuer, Robert O'Donnell, couldn't handle the stress of having been a hero in the world's eyes, only to see the spotlight snatched away so quickly. He bored co-workers with endless stories of his time in the hole, squabbled with fellow rescuers over payment for the TV movie, developed a dependence on prescription painkillers, and in 1995 took his own life with a shotgun blast to the head. The Cue Creek miners are also having problems, the Washington Post reported last week. One of the miners, John Unger, fled Somerset County for a vacation at the beach. Alone one night, he began digging a hole in the sand until it was big enough for him to fit into. He stayed in that hole until 2 a.m. Bob Long, who pinpointed rescue efforts outside the mine, has become the source of the miners' resentment because he got an equal share of the Movie of the Week payments. Perhaps most interesting is what happened to Skeets Miller, who interviewed Floyd Collins in 1925. He left Louisville soon after he won his Pulitzer and moved to radio. By 1947, he was at NBC, where he served as assignment editor for the company's newest venture, television. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Oh, come on, you young people, and listen while I tell the fate of Floyd Collins, the lad we all knew well. His face was fair and handsome, his heart was true and brave. His body now lies sleeping in a lonely sandstone cave. Oh, mother, don't you worry, dear father.
13 years ago, the rape and beating of a jogger in Central Park shocked New York City and the world. When a group of black and Hispanic teenagers were arrested for the crime, shock turned to rage. But recently, another man has stepped forward to claim responsibility for the crime, and a reexamination of the confessions and evidence that helped convict those teenagers raises lots of questions.
So far, the latest chapter in the story of one of New York's most notorious crimes has played out like many wrongful conviction stories. The questions center mostly on why the kids would confess to a crime they didn't commit, and why DNA evidence that didn't match was ignored. But we thought it would be instructive to look back on another aspect of this case, the atmosphere in 1989 and the media frenzy surrounding the original case. Newsday columnist Ellis Hennekin covered the Central Park jogger case in 1989, and he joins me now. Ellis, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brooke. Good to be with you.
Okay, let's consider New York in 1989. Bensonhurst and Howard Beach had ceased to become merely the names of neighborhoods and had become practically synonymous with racial strife. Al Sharpton had become a household name. What's the right way to describe the city before the attack?
It was a tough time. I mean, a lot of racial bad feelings on both sides. And then there was the overlay of the worst crime wave in the history of the city. You're talking about 2,000 murders a year in those days. This is the height of the crack epidemic. So if you're a white person in New York, you're thinking, boy, crime is out of control. If you're a black person in New York, you're thinking, boy, is crime out of control. And boy, are the police out of control, too. So you throw all that together with a little urban demagoguery tossed in, and you have a lot of tension in the air and a big time for the tabloid press.
And then you've got the assumption that it was kids who did this crime, and the word wilding became popular. This was on the cover of all the tabloids, and it was both an explanation and an accusation.
The Central Park jogger case was an irresistible story at that time. I mean, there's so many elements of it. It's in Central Park, which is everybody's backyard. It is cross-racial. You've got young black defendants against an upper-class white victim, horribly beaten and raped and abused. And there are always those kinds of attitudes that we all bring to a story like that. And one of them is the assumption that a group of young black kids running around the middle of the night in Central Park is, and people reach for these terms all the time, but it's almost animalistic. So when a cop tells a reporter the kids said something like, "We be wilding," that was an irresistible term for the front page of every newspaper in this town.
By the way, here's the first sentence of an article from the Daily News, which ran just a few weeks ago. It says, one of the most savage entries in New York's crime annals, the 1989 Central Park wilding attack on a female jogger, may have to be rewritten. It still sticks with us.
Well, you know, that word is a troubling word. We never heard it directly from any of these kids. And I've got to tell you, it was a term that I had never heard before. And I've really never heard anybody say again, except in connection with that case.
How much do you think the media fed this frenzy? And how much do you think the media are to blame for the convictions?
Well, secondarily, I mean, there's certainly some blame that we deserve in terms of promoting feelings that were out there. But let's not go overboard with that. I mean, the police made this arrest in a hurry before the first reporter wrote the first story. They had supposedly extracted confessions from these kids while this thing was just bubbling into the papers. The trial proceeded with great public outcry. I mean, you had feminists marching on the steps of the courthouse demanding justice for the jogger. You had the normal racial pandering back and forth on a story like this.
Do you have any regrets about the way you covered the story?
Well, you know, I think we were naive. I think that we had a case that the detectives and the prosecutors tied a nice big red ribbon around. And as a result of what we now appears to be sloppy police work, overzealous prosecution, and a gullible press, we ended up with a bunch of kids in jail for a crime it now seems they did not commit. Anyone within 100 miles of that ought to feel that they have a little bit of guilt on their hands because of it, and I count myself on that list.
Well, Ellis, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks. It's a nasty story, but we got to be back at it, Brooke.
Ellis Hennekin is a columnist for Newsday.
Coming up, why it's important to get facts straight when writing fiction, and a new interface opens the world of video gaming to the blind.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm Brooke Gladstone. There are novelists that turn to reporting, like, for instance, Norman Mailer and Gore Vidal, and there are reporters that turn to novel writing, like, say, Pete Hamill or Laura Lippman, an award-winning mystery writer who spent a dozen years covering real-life crime for the Baltimore Sun. Lippman, whose latest novel is called The Last Place, noticed one strange phenomenon when she made the switch to fiction. Her readers, who rarely questioned her facts when she was a crime reporter, were suddenly on her back for accuracy when she entered the land of make-believe. She joins us now. Laura, thanks for coming on.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So it's been your experience that readers pay more attention to facts in novels than they do in news reports?
Altogether, I was a reporter for 20 years because I was in Texas before I came back home to Baltimore. And I've noticed that I receive so much more email about the books than I ever did about what I was writing for the newspaper. And since it's only been a year since I left the newspaper, this can't just be an example of people having internet access in greater numbers. They just seem to care so much more about the credibility of the world of Tess Monahan than they ever cared about anything I wrote for the Baltimore Sun.
Now, she's the detective that you've created who runs through your books.
Yes, she's been in 7 books. This is the 7th book coming out. And I guess it's a sort of compliment in that she's become real enough to readers that they want her world to be real, too.
You've lived in Baltimore for a long time. You grew up there?
Yes, I grew up here and came back here to work as soon as I could.
And do you find that fellow Baltimoreans get on to you when you make a factual error about your hometown?
I believe it's become a great sport among local readers to try to find errors, and they really keep me on my toes. So far, I would assert that I've never been caught in a mistake about Baltimore, but I can't convince readers of that because they sometimes get confused about what I'm making up. I'm often told, often, that I have made a mistake about the place where my heroine lives. And I try to convince people that it doesn't actually exist, that the cross streets may be true, but the building isn't there, so therefore the alley isn't there, and so therefore I can't possibly have the door in the wrong place, which is something I've heard quite a bit.
What other sorts of mistakes tend to inspire the letter writers?
Well, there's firearms. I received an email from a man this year that began, "Dear Ms. Lippman, I don't know how you sleep at night, given the errors you have made about firearms and telecommunications."
What mistake were they objecting to?
I put a safety on a gun that doesn't have a safety.
Shame on you.
I know. I make mistakes when I'm absolutely sure I'm right. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing, and the fact that I had taken shooting lessons and taken the time to do my research, the fact that I keep a book on 9mm, you know, close at hand when I'm writing, those things made me complacent, and I didn't check it out. And the only reason there was even a reference to the safety is I'm very interested in showing my character as a responsible gun owner.
Do you take more time checking your facts as a novelist than you did as a reporter?
Absolutely, because there are 2 tiers of facts. This is not to suggest that I was careless as a reporter. I was pretty anal retentive about it. But, you know, at this point, I've written over 700,000 words about Tess Monahan. There's a pretty large body of biography, and I will get complaints from readers if I contradict myself from book to book. They're paying that close of attention. So that's the first tier of facts I have to go through. And then when I get a manuscript in copy-edited form, I have to make a list of every fact in the book, and I then have to double-check it.
Laura, what's the mistake you made that bothered you the most?
Well, it was in a Strange City, and it was about Groucho Marx. And I am positively arrogant about my knowledge of the Marx Brothers.
So in that book, you were flaunting your Groucho knowledge?
Yes, just tossing it off. I know exactly what I did. My character was watching a show on what in the book is called the far right end of the cable dial. Think Bill O'Reilly crossed with Chris Matthews. And it is her observation that, like the character Groucho Marx played in Duck Soup, he might as well be singing the song, "Whatever it is, I'm against it." And then one day I received the sweetest email from a man who lives right around here. And he said, I hate to tell you this, but Groucho sang that in Horse Feathers. And I knew instantly he was right. And I felt so sheepish.
Just another story of the anguish of the novelist's life.
Oh, yes.
Laura Lippman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Laura Lippman is an award-winning mystery writer whose latest novel is called The Last Place. By By now you've probably heard of TiVo, the little black box that digitally records your chosen programs for you to watch whenever you please, and if you please, minus the commercials. It's revolutionized the way its users watch TV and sent a scare through advertisers. It's the wave of the future. But as Brenton Kerner wrote in a recent issue of Slate.com, the future may come too late for TiVo. His story titled TiVo, We Hardly Knew Ye, was practically an obituary, even though the early adopters who worship the technology are totally hooked.
I'll tell you, I have a very close friend of mine who recently got a TiVo, and I haven't seen the guy since. There's a tremendous consumer loyalty to this product.
But they are still the few and the brave. According to your article, TiVo isn't going to last long. Why not?
Well, I don't think so. I think that you're talking here about they are the kind of revolutionizers of this technology, the what we call the first mover, the first company into the fray. Unfortunately, I think history shows that in technology, the first mover often doesn't last for the long run. I think a good example of a first mover that tanked quite recently is Commodore Computers. They had a product that came out in 1985, I believe, called the Amiga, which was this amazing full-color screen computer with great multimedia features. It had music programming, video editors, that sort of thing that we now take for granted in all PCs. But they were about 10, 15 years ahead of the curve, and so there wasn't really a market for it at that time. And so it's very frustrating, for example, for Commodore shareholders and Commodore employees to see the Macintosh nowadays incorporating many Amiga-like features, and Commodore went bankrupt. They had nothing to show for all their efforts.
Well, wasn't part of the problem with the Amiga that it was just a little too complicated for the average American technophobe, which, let's face it, is a big part of the market? And is TiVo like the Amiga in this respect? Just too many plugs and buttons?
I think that's true. And for, you know, a geek or a journalist like myself, it doesn't seem that complicated. But I think that people want things, especially entertainment devices, to be as simple to learn as possible. The Amiga, they wanted people to plug into their home entertainment centers. And this is in the mid-80s. People had just gotten, you know, VCRs a couple of years beforehand. So they weren't quite ready to make that next leap. I think the same thing with the TiVo. It's not complicated, but for someone who still has their VCR in their living room, going through these computerized menus on their screen is a little bit complex.
But as you say, a lot of the Amiga technology was later incorporated into other items. What do you think is going to happen to the TiVo technology? Is that going to begin showing up in later products?
I think it already is, actually. You're already seeing some cable companies talking about incorporating TiVo-like technology into their cable boxes. So therefore, you'll have this capacity to digitally record shows, you know, already packaged in with your cable box. No muss, no fuss for consumers. I also think PCs are going to start coming with this kind of software included. So it's already in this box you already own. Therefore, no need to go out and get this kind of one-trick pony sort of a digital video recorder that TiVo's offering right now.
So does that mean that TiVo goes under, or does TiVo merely sell its special technology?
Well, I think licensing their technology is going to be a big part of their future. I also think the fact that they have such high brand name recognition. People use TiVo as a verb, and I'm going to TiVo that show or this show. I think bodes well for them maybe being bought out by a bigger player down the line. But in terms of their current business strategy of having standalone video recorders, I don't think that's the future for the technology.
And yet some of these defunct first movers acquire a certain cult status, don't they?
They really do. And all you have to do is scour the web and enter in the word Amiga into a search engine. You'll find plenty of fan sites and fan pages. I call them nerd aficionados. And I think the same thing will happen to TiVo down the line.
All right. Brenton Kerner, thank you very much.
Thanks a million.
Freelance reporter Brenton Kerner's last article, TiVo, We Hardly Knew Ye, appeared in Slate.com.
Technological innovation can make life more interesting for everybody, but the computer is not the be-all and end-all for the estimated 1 million Americans who are totally blind. For them, access to computers is mostly about the basics: word processing, email, the killer applications that Curtis Chong, technology director for the National Federation of the Blind, calls survival tools. Meanwhile, all the major players in the multi-billion dollar video and computer game industry, like PlayStation 2, GameCube, and Xbox, are moving their games online. But all this new technology is likely to leave the blind stranded yet again, cut off from the burgeoning community of online gamers. Susan Kaplan reports on one possible solution.
Eight of hearts, king of clubs, four of clubs, ten of spades, four of diamonds. It's Susan Bott's turn to bet.
When Paul Silva, a student at the University of Massachusetts, wanted to play video and computer games with one of his closest friends, he couldn't. Blind since birth, Tim Keenan could never join Silva. So Silva, Keenan, and fellow student Jeremy Spitzer hatched an idea to create a software company to make games Keenan could play.
We were sitting in our dorm room one day and said, you know what, we didn't want to necessarily spend the rest of our lives doing physics. And we had a passion to create a business that was going to make some kind of a difference, and we wanted it to make games because we loved making games. The running joke was that I was a physicist and Jeremy was a landscape architect, and we decided to make video games for the blind. It made many family members scratch their heads.
Silva says despite the odds, he began to craft a business plan, beginning with research to find out if there even was a market for computer games for the blind and sighted to play together. Curtis Chong of the National Federation of the Blind says there is a market because the current crop of games for the blind are audio only and not very interesting for anybody.
They do not foster interactivity between the blind and the sighted. One of the tenets of the National Federation of the Blind is integration and on a basis of equality between the blind and the sighted. So if you look at the state of the art in terms of games, first of all, commercial games, we simply disregard them. Why? Because the odds are incredibly high that they will be not accessible and unusable by somebody who is blind. You know, it's kind of like the outer limits. We will control the transmission. We will determine when the speech happens. The blind person does not have to learn how to run their screen reader because we, Z-Form, will talk and make the computer speak. So a model for how to make stuff accessible is there.
Chong says one well-designed aspect of the game is that players can choose to have their cards called. This may be confusing to a sighted person, but Chong says the blind can take in audio information at a much faster speed than people who can see.
You play against other people who are sitting at this virtual poker table on the internet. And the software does not care, the players do not care, who is blind and who is sighted.
Z-Form's Paul Silva says once he figured out there was a market for more accessible games, the next step was to get help.
We're young, we've got energy, we've got passion, we lack experience. Let's try and rectify that. And so we started building a board of advisors and have continued to build it since then.
Since then, the game has garnered lots of good press, but despite the media attention, Silva acknowledges the market is a small one. And Jennifer Olson, the editor of Game Developer magazine, finds it hard to imagine the big game manufacturers will put much into making their products more accessible to the blind.
They don't believe this market is worth serving, or if they haven't identified it as large enough, then I'm not sure it would just magically behoove them to address it.
Still, Z-Form CEO Paul Silva says many companies like Microsoft and AOL are making efforts to address the needs of the blind. But like Chong, he says the bulk of their attention is on the basics like word processing, not games. Silva says he gets emails every day from people from the blind community who are grateful to have a seat at the table in the virtual community of online gaming.
I got one a few weeks ago from a father who said, "Thank you. For the first time, I have a game I can play with my two-sighted daughters. I just wish they weren't so good at poker."
Z-Form hopes to have a new accessible game published in about a year. To play poker, go to zform.com where you can sign up for a free 15-day trial period. As to the question, why poker, and concerns that it could promote gambling, the game makers say poker is a universally known, simple-to-play game, and the money used is phony, not real, so they felt it wouldn't pose much of a threat. Curtis Chong from the National Federation of the Blind echoes these thoughts. He says Z-Form online poker with its virtual chips is as benign as playing checkers or chess. For On the Media, I'm Susan Kaplan.
And joining me now with a similar innovation is James Forminard, who has developed a device called the Casino Reader. Welcome to OTM.
Thanks very much, Brooke.
So tell me about your device.
Well, it's a handheld scanner that's used in casinos so that people with visual problems can enjoy one of America's fastest growing recreation activities, gaming.
This may sound silly, but can't visually impaired people play blackjack and craps and roulette?
Well, those games, yes. You know, the dealer or croupier, if you will, calls out what the player has. But there's one important exception, Brooke. Poker.
Ah, and that's where the Casino Reader comes in.
Correct. I get my cards dealt face down. So if I'm blind, which I'm not, but I have friends who are. But if I'm blind, how do I read the cards?
Well, they could be in Braille.
I thought of that, but the bumps end up interfering with shuffling. Anyway, if you just hold the casino reader device over the cards, it tells you what you have.
I see you brought one into the studio with you.
Right. This is our personal model. We also have one that's actually mounted over the table. But this one here, let's power it up.
I'll deal. Five-card draw and... There, you should have five cards in front of you.
Right, okay, now let's get ready to read.
Six of clubs, seven of clubs, nine of spades, eight of spades, queen of diamonds.
I'll take three cards.
And I'll take one.
Four of clubs.
I'll bet a dollar.
I'll see your dollar and raise you five.
I'll raise you back five.
Call.
I have a pair of sevens.
I just had a queen high. I was bluffing.
Yeah. James, isn't there a fundamental flaw with the casino reader?
You're right, Brooke, and I'm glad you brought that up. A card player needs not only to read his cards, but also read his opponent's expressions. So with a facial recognition attachment, you just hold it up to your opponent's face, like I'm doing right now. Just play a high card. I have...
Eight of spades.
Here, pick a card, any card. Just look at it and see if you beat my eight.
Brow furrowed, lips pursed, pupil dilation moderate.
I think I beat you, Brooke.
No, actually, I had a nine.
Oh, you were bluffing. Very, very good, Brooke.
Well, James, thanks for coming in. It was a pleasure.
Pupil dilation high, bluff alert, bluff alert.
Thank you.
James Forminard is the inventor of the casino reader.
Ears perked, teeth grinding, hair unruly, bluff alert, bluff warning, danger, danger, stop the humanoid.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, George Edwards, and Irene Trudell, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Natasha Kurganker, Andy Lancet, Sharon Bidwell, and Sean Collins. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.